Good morning.
Good morning.
And good morning. So this morning I'd like to talk about a Zen archetype, the archetype of the fool. And those of you who heard me talk, my last talk, I talked about Bodhisattva Manjushri, this guy here, and Maitreya. And at the end of the talk, I said that one of the manifestations of Maitreya is the manifestation of the fool. But I only spent 5 minutes on that, and being a foolish fellow, I thought, why not spend a whole talk or five talks on that? So here we go. A fool. Well, the fool really is one of the, I would say, main differentiating characteristics between Zen Buddhism and other forms of Buddhism, is that you find that the fool in Zen at the very beginning and in the very end, although we don't know when the end's going to be, but up until the present day. And I want to suggest that there are five different characteristics in Zen practice, Zen life, of the fool, which are, it's an archetype, right? It's something that is that we learn to manifest through our practice. It's archetypal, it's already there. We learn to manifest it. So the first one, the fool. The fool loves contradiction. The fool loves contradiction. The fool loves paradox. Most people, most of the time, don't like contradiction. Most people, most of the time, don't like paradox. But the fool does. And if you read Zen stories in China, the early Zen stories, they're full of contradiction. 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 So much so that when I teach, I don't even teach those stories very much because it's hard to teach them. It's really hard to teach them. It's hard to have a class just on these from the 8th century because of the contradiction, contradiction, contradiction. So here's an example. One of many, many examples. A monk asked the sixth ancestor of Zen, who has attained to the secrets of Wobai, Wobai being the mountain where the fifth ancestor resided. The sixth ancestor replied, "One who understands Buddhism has attained to the secrets of Wobai." "Have you attained them?" "No, I have not." "How is it," asked the monk, "that you have not?" "I do not understand Buddhism," said the teacher. There we go. There we go. And so, drawing on one of my favorite British Buddhist scriptures, Alice in Wonderland, which is nothing if not full of contradiction and paradox. And poor Alice is just trying to keep her life together. And she encounters contradiction after contradiction after contradiction. And here she is with the Red Queen. "I didn't mean anything," said Alice. "That's just what I complain of," said the Red Queen. "You should have meant. Even a joke should have some meaning. And a child's more important than a joke, I hope." "You couldn't deny that, even if you tried with both hands." "I don't deny things with my hands," Alice objected. "Nobody said you did," said the Red Queen. "I said you couldn't if you tried." Contradiction. And as a result of contradiction, as a result of getting comfortable with contradiction, because we all have lots of contradictions in our lives, we're able to embrace contrariness. The contrariness. Contrariness. Contrary to our thoughts, contrary to what we're trying to accomplish this morning, contrary to trying to be calm here while you're sitting. Contrary, contrary, contrary. We begin to embrace contrariness. So the earliest Zen characters were monastic, but then there were the guys outside the monasteries. There were the contraries. The first two Zen contraries that I know of were Hanshan and Shite. Hanshan and Shite. Hanshan and Shite, who stayed outside the monastery, and Hanshan carried a broom, usually sweeping, and he had long, frizzy, kind of hippy-dippy hair, right? And he was trying to, whenever a monk or a priest would pass, he would sweep. But he wouldn't just sweep the ground, he would sweep them, he would sweep the sky. Somebody asked him what he was sweeping. He said, "I'm trying to sweep the cobwebs from your minds." And then Shite, with his mirror, who hung out, they were like Laurel and Hardy. I don't know who was Laurel and who was Hardy, but Hanshan was real tall, so maybe he was like Laurel, but Laurel wasn't real tall. I don't know. The other one usually carried a mirror, and if you looked in the mirror, you saw nothing. There was nothing there, and so this was their way of mimicking the life of the monks, the life of the priests, who were so full of themselves, who were trying to get it right, who were trying to manifest stillness in their lives, who were trying to become shuso, who were trying to become teachers, and were so serious about it that they didn't see their blind spots, that they didn't see their own kind of holy hypocrisy. So in Zen, we always have to have the fool to remind us of that. Always, always. Didn't see the folly of the fictional self. Oh, the folly of the fictional self. Either we can cry about it or we can laugh at it. Sometimes we do both. Sometimes we do one and then the other. The other and then one. That's fine. It's fine. For fools, we don't mind. We don't mind. So in the shamanic traditions, the contrary, the sacred clown, is very, very important. Very, very important. Guy or gal, but usually a guy. Could be a gal, but could be a woman, right? And some of you know that I spent time practicing Lakota spirituality, Lakota shamanism, from 1985 to 1990, I worked with a Lakota teacher, and my Lakota teacher had been a Heoka. Do you know how? Raise your hand if you know what Heoka means. Don't know what Heoka means. Huh? Yeah. A Heoka is in Lakota spirituality. A Heoka has a vision of the thunder beings, and when you have a vision of the thunder beings, then you know that you have a Heoka spirit, and you need to manifest it in the world. And it's a doing everything backwards spirit. The Heoka does everything backwards. Everything backwards. And so Elmer, who was my teacher, had been a Heoka. And I said, "Boy, that must have been fun, being a Heoka." He said, "It wasn't fun." Said, especially at first, it was not fun. Because we know we have our form. We have our form of how we live, what we do when we get up, when we have our coffee, when we come to Zen Center, when we oversleep. We know we have our form, our nice little form. And then it's disrupted. So the reason for the Heoka, in most non-literate religions, there's a Heoka. There's a contrary who has a role. Is to remind us of that and to loosen us up. So Elmer told me once, he said, "I'll tell you a story about when I was a Heoka and I had to do everything backwards." And he said, "Luckily, I only had to be a Heoka for 1 year." I don't know why. I don't know why, for 1 year. He said, "Well, you know, we practice all my relatives in Lakota. So we're expected to give. We're expected to give. We're expected to be generous. And everybody's paying attention to who's the most generous. Just like in some unnameable church that some of us grew up in. Everyone is expected to pay attention, be more and more generous, more and more generous. Of course, underneath, people are comparing and feeling jealousy and rivalry. Who's going to be the holiest? Who's going to be... So the Heilka's job is to be selfish, not give anything, just to remind people that there's the shadow side that they're trying to keep away from, that they're not really being open, that they're just trying to follow a model in their head. So Elmer said one time, he had friends coming over, and his wife had bought a case of beer. And if those of you, if you guys have hung out on the reservations very much, and maybe you haven't, I don't expect you have. You know there's a lot of beer on the reservations. And it's expected that you share your beer, too. You share your beer, definitely. But Elmer's friends were coming over. He was a Heilka. He saw his wife had bought a case of beer, so he needed to hide it because he wasn't going to share it. Because his job was not to share. So what did he do? He put it in the oven. Well, they had a tiny house. His wife came in and turned on the oven. And then Elmer said to me, I was glad when my job as a Heilka was over. So all of us in our lives, sometimes we feel like we're out of step with other people. Like we're out of step with our spouse or our culture or our community. We feel out of step. And then we're contraries. Then we're contraries. And usually then we want to get in step and we want to pretend we're not out of step. And that's fine. It's just the question of seeing that. Of just seeing that. And not doing anything about it except appreciating that it's part of this drama of life. So I'm a left-handed person. Left-handed people, we used to have more problems. We don't have too many problems now. But I'm pretty old, and when we were young, we had problems. Mrs. Werner tried to teach me to write with my right hand in the first grade. Ever since that time, my handwriting felt awful. Just awful. Because in the second grade, Mrs. Liebendorf said, oh, Tim, you will never be able to write with your right hand. You should do it with your left hand. But I had spent a year struggling with my right hand, failing. So, we all have some experience of being contrary, whether we like it or not. When I was my first summer at the Zen monastery, I'd been practicing Zen Buddhism for already 3 years. And I've told this story before. My teacher brought out nested eating bowls, or yokis, which we had never done. We just ate with knives and forks and plates and tried to be still, mindful. But there they were, these nested eating bowls. But they were for right-handed people. Everything was done for a right-handed person. And I asked the young Japanese guy, I said, what about left-handed people? He said, no left-handed people. No left-handed people. Give me a break. So I struggled with it. I struggled with it. And I tried to sneak in some left-handed things because I just couldn't do it right-handed. And now the norm in this culture is left-handed people don't have to do it in the right-handed way. If you've noticed, you can watch me. One of the early students with me, Ed Brown, and I were both left-handed, and we both had the same struggle. But I felt like a fool. There I was in public in front of everybody. We're trying to be still. I'm clacking with my spoon. I'm spilling food. Complete fool. So I said to Suzuki Roshi, I hate this. I just want to do Zazen. Why did you introduce this? And he said, you hate it. Well, very good. He said, look deeply into that. Look deeply into that. Very good, Tim. Very good. Well, So, contrariness. So, when I took an acting class in college. I took a bunch of acting classes in college. And I seemed to always get the role of some bad person. And I wanted only to play heroes, but for one reason I was too short to play most of the heroes. For another reason, I don't know. I don't know. And I was really tired of playing Harold Pinter one acts. I'm really tired of those. Especially because I was a Zen student. I was cultivating equanimity, generosity, friendliness. So I said to my teacher, Gerald Hyken, and my teacher, Gerald Hyken, had practiced Hindu meditation for years. I said, come on, give me a break. This was not formal kind of theater. It was okay for me. We call everybody by first names in this. I said, give me a break, you know. Give me a chance to play at least someone who's kind of nice. I said, I'm trying to practice. I'm trying to stay calm and manifest calmness in the world. And you're having me play these mean, evil, cranky, nasty people? He said, yes. He said, well, Tim, I thought you were on a spiritual path. I said, yeah, I'm on a spiritual path. He said, but I thought your spiritual path was Zen. And I said, yes, it's Zen. He said, well, my teacher told me that only when I discovered how bad I was, only when I completely contacted, discovered, and accepted how bad I was, could I know the wisdom of being. So I finished that class, but I didn't take another class from that class. But I get to use it in a talk. So, you know, there's always a use for something that happens to you, you know. You never know what it's going to be. But and this is probably the second time I've used it in a talk in 5 or 6 years, and I'll be able to use it every 2 or 3 years because you guys will forget. Or I'll forget or something. So, the fool loves contradiction, and as a result, embraces contrariness. The fool trusts. The fool trusts, number two, trusts. Does the fool trust in people? No. People will let you down sooner or later. No. Even the person you trust the most is going to be letting you down sooner or later. Either they'll let you down by something they do, or they won't be there for you, or they won't live up to your expectations, or they'll let you down. No, the true fool doesn't trust in people. Not too much. Does the fool trust in experience? No, experience is not a good predictor of anything. Experience is very unpredictable. No, the fool certainly doesn't trust the objects of the world, because the objects of the world come and go as they come and go, not according to us, right? The fool just trusts, not anything. If you trust anything or anyone, you're not returning to your fool nature, your original fool nature. Hey, somebody calls it the Buddha nature, but it's really the fool nature. Okay? So the great fool Ryokan, right? 18th century Japan. Great, great Japanese Zen master, Ryokan. Everybody called him the great fool. He was a great fool. No doubt about it. So a story of which I may have told in my last talk, I don't remember. Sorry. Ryokan played with kids. He liked to play hide and seek with kids. And so one day he was playing hide and seek with kids, and he found a really good hiding place. So good that the kids couldn't find him, and they all went home, and he was still hiding. You can read about this in his biography if you'd like. If you want to read about a foolish fellow, maybe you don't. And he kept hiding for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. Then finally I guess he went home. And so everybody made fun of him. The kids especially made fun of Ryoko. Oh, the fool, Ryoko. And so he was a fool. But was he a fool? He was hiding. He was being there in stillness, being wherever he was, in darkness and in stillness, listening, smelling, feeling. You may call that behavior foolish if you want to. We don't care. Yeah, it's foolish. It's totally foolish. It's foolish for me to come here every morning. Completely foolish. Who cares? Who cares? So Milton Erickson was a great fool. Milton Erickson was a great fool. And Milton Erickson was a child. He had cerebral palsy. He really had it badly. He had it so badly that he was really crippled. We don't use that word cripple much anymore because it's not PC, right? But he was really crippled. And he had to spend a lot of time in bed. So all the time he spent in bed, he learned to watch. He learned to listen. He learned to pay attention. He learned to be with his foolish, crippled body. And then when he was an adolescent, he regained enough mobility. He started going to school. He could actually attain enough mobility so go to school by 10. By the time he was 16, he was actually going to school. This was a farm and farm life in Wisconsin. They shouldn't have any special education then. And the kids made fun of him. Remember how mean kids are? Do you remember how mean they are? They made fun of him. The fool Milty. He can barely walk to the back of the class. And so he dealt with that contrariness, that feeling like he pushed aside us. That became, but that helped his bare attention. So there's a story there. Lots of stories about Milton Erickson. If you get trained as a therapist, I don't know if this is true anymore. I don't know. Before all this cognitive behavioral stuff, and not to offend the cognitive behavioral people, but before all this cognitive behavioral stuff, and we got trained as therapists, we got trained, some of us in Milton Erickson style. So teaching tales. Here's one of Milton Erickson's teaching tales. I'll give a short version. Milton Erickson said, "When I was 16, and I lived in a farming country. After school one day, I was limping home from school, although it didn't seem like limping to me, and I came across a horse. And the horse was just there, and I could tell that it was it belonged on a farm. And Milton Erickson knew how to ride. So he said, I said something to the horse, and I got up on the horse and stayed on his back and rode him. And the horse moved around and went over from here to there and different places. And then, after a while, the horse pulled up into a farmyard, into the edge of the barn. And he said, and the farmer came running out. And he said, oh, he saw Milty, the cripple Milty, the fool Milty, riding on his horse. And he said, oh, I've been looking all over for my horse. I've been worried about it. She's my prize mare. How did you know how to get her home? And Milton said, I didn't know. The horse knew. So that's the fool. That's the second aspect of the fool. Trusting. The third one is that the fool relinquishes. The fool renunciates. We are renunciants. If you want to do this practice, you need to become a renunciant. You need to relinquish. And sooner or later, you will relinquish. But first, you have to consciously become a renunciant for you to relinquish like this. You have to consciously do it. So we renounce. We renounce attachment to privilege, attachment to position, attachment to any kind of sense of being better or less foolish or even more foolish than other people are. We renounce that. We renounce that. Now, if you look at the history of Buddhism, it's not so good. You see that actually, you see that Buddhists themselves, historically, have often not renounced the oppressive establishment in the country that the Buddhism was being practiced. You had to have people like Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi just sort of not be okay with it and go to the side. And then you had a few courageous people. But for the most part, historically, Buddhism is no better than Christianity in terms of this issue. Maybe a little bit better. Maybe a little bit better because we practice meditation. But I don't know. I don't know. So that's the first thing, to renounce. But that's just part of the bigger thing, is that we're renouncing and then relinquishing this kind of hypnotic trance that I always talk about, right? This self-conscious hypnotic trance. That's why Hanshan held up the mirror, because he knew that all the monks, when they passed, would want to look at the mirror and see themselves. Were they dressing properly? Did they look calm enough? Did they have the right demeanor to really manifest the Dharma? Or were they just all freaked out? But that's why he showed them there was nothing there. Completely nothing. So relinquishing, renouncing our fixation on self-consciousness. So I was in Bhutan 3 years ago, and I didn't tell this story yet. I was in Bhutan 3 years ago where the Buddhists practiced the way I think the Tibetan Buddhists practiced, very similar before the Chinese came in. And I went to ceremonies in Bhutan. Bhutan, the people are very modest. And Bhutanese culture, you never talk about sexuality. I don't know what they'd think if they came here in the 21st century and they turned on the internet. I don't know what they'd think. Yeah, I think if they came back here in the 18th century, they'd be okay. In the 21st century. So they're very modest. They don't show flesh. They don't talk about anything to have to do with body parts, with sex, anything like that. That's part of their culture, right? It's part of who they are. But, they have a contrary. They have a ritual contrary. And the ritual contrary appears at the rituals. And I didn't know this until I actually went to a ritual. I went to the ritual, to this big pageant, and all these people were standing around in their robes and being very, and you know, it was wonderful, very colorful. And then there was this guy in this costume with this huge phallus, right? He has a huge cloth-wrapped phallus that he's, I don't know if it's attached to him, or I can't remember. I think it's attached to him, actually. And he's running around the ring. I mean, we're looking at the ceremony. He's running around the ring swinging his phallus and doing all kinds of rude and lewd things, which we will not get into in a spiritual setting like this one. And so after I said to my guide, I said, "What is that all about?" And he said, "I shouldn't talk about you publicly. Come over here where there are no women. I'll tell you about it." This is their culture, right? This is their culture. So he said, "Oh, he is someone who is training to be a lama, and this is an important part of lama practice. It doesn't come until you've reached a certain point in your lama practice where you can begin to let go of self-consciousness. This is a practice then that you do as you're practicing letting go of self-consciousness, as you're practicing just being and not being caught by your image. He said, did you like it? And I said, well, I liked it, but I was surprised. And that phallus was huge. And he smiled just a little bit. He said, yes, it was, wasn't it? He said, but don't talk about it. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? It's very interesting. Very interesting. Those are Buddhists, right? Whatever that means to be Buddhist. So the fourth one is giving, dana, which you hear about a lot in Buddhism. But giving, the fool gives. The fool gives. Putai, 11th century. Hote in Japan. The foolish Dharma teachers who teach by what? Giving oranges. They carried huge sacks of oranges on their back and just give them. That's their teaching. That's their preaching of the Dharma. Giving oranges to children, to people. So my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, when we had a sitting group in my hometown, he would come down once a week and then he would pass the dana basket. Oh no, he wouldn't pass it, and we didn't have a nice dana basket like that. I passed a little collection basket because these people were not members of our Zen Center in San Francisco. And so I passed the collection basket. Then at the end, I would give it to Suzuki Roshi to take back. And the first couple of times, he left it with me. And I thought, well, you know, he's just absent-minded. So then I said, gave it to him. And he said, oh, yes, yes. But then he left it with me again. Then I tried actually putting it out by the third or fourth time, out by, just on top of his, where he had his packet of robes. And still, he left it with me. And then he said, it's for you. He said, you offer all your effort. And I said, no. But he wouldn't take it. He would never take it. So I just kept it. I was a hungry student, a hungry college student. Well, I wasn't hungry by Japanese standards, that's for sure. I thought I was hungry, but he had lived off weeds in the Second World War. In the Second World War, they lived off weeds. They boiled weeds. So I kept it because, well, I was so grateful, and he just wouldn't take it. But then I got a surprise one day. My grandmother gave me a whole bunch of money. And immediately, without thinking, I signed it over to Suzuki Roshi. I was a total fool. I just signed it. I couldn't help it. I couldn't help it. That kind of giving just comes up and it sustains itself. When someone gives to you, you can't help giving back. If you're a fool, you can't help it. And we sustain our practice in our lives, moment by moment, century by century, passing the gift along. And that's the act of gratitude that just wells up and gives. So there's no idea. And somebody was giving a talk once and said there's a hallmark. Who was that? One of you guys said that there's a hallmark slogan about that now on TV. Give the gift that keeps on giving or something. Oh my goodness. Well, it's true. Commercialize it or don't commercialize it, it's true. It's what sustained our practice in Buddhism for 2,500 years. I wouldn't have given him a cent. I wouldn't have given him anything if he hadn't just kept giving to me without even trying to be the thing he was giving. We call that in Buddhism what? The threefold purity. No idea of giver, no idea of gift, no idea of action or giving. Beyond self-consciousness. You can all do it. You've all done it at times in your lives. If you've done it at one time, you can do it at two times. If you've done it at two times, you can do it at three times. And the fifth manifestation of the fool is courage. The fool is courageous. courageous. And when I was talking about this last time, I gave Martin Luther King as an example, but so I won't talk about him today. I'll give it two other examples instead. Courageous. The fool is courageous. As I said last time, the fool rushes in where angels fear to tread. The fool just does. She doesn't know. She's courageous. So there's an organization now internationally that was started here 10 years ago by Mel Duncan. It's called the Nonviolent Peace Force. And the Nonviolent Peace Force goes into countries where there is war and attempts to mediate, attempts to be there to support both sides, to decrease the violence and support the citizenry, the local people. In most wars, the level of fatality among people who don't have anything to do with the war is much higher than among soldiers, people who are just hanging out in their villages and their towns. So the Nonviolent Peace Force representative came here, one of the representatives who worked in Sri Lanka, came here a month and a half ago, and I heard him speak. And in Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka is a Buddhist country, and what have the Buddhists been doing in Sri Lanka for one of the longest undeclared civil wars historically in Asia? The Buddhists have been oppressing the Hindus. They've been oppressing the Hindus, the Tamil Tigers, the Hindus. Just as I said. And so the Nonviolent Peace Force has been in Sri Lanka, and they have 24 people there, and they go in unarmed, and they attempt to mediate. And one of the things they do is attempt to protect boys who are 9, 10, and 11, and 12 from being taken and drafted into the military. Because what the Tamil Tigers do is that they steal boys. They kidnap boys. And they take them and they make them child soldiers. And this has been going on for a long time. So he told us this story of being there. And first of all, getting permission from the rebels to go talk with them. And then going and talking with them. And wearing the Nonviolent Peace Force uniforms just to kind of signify who they are. And being able actually to spend enough time with the rebels and shame them enough so that they gave a whole bunch of 10 and 11-year-old boys back to their families. And how wonderful that work was. And somebody asked him, well, isn't the United Nations there? And he said, well, the United Nations is there, but they won't do this work. They think we're fools. And I said, the other person too, said, oh, they think you're fools? Yes, because we go in unarmed. Because we believe if we go in with arms, we will not be able to save those boys' lives. So we go in unarmed. And so far, they've had nobody has been killed. And they're fools. They're complete fools. They're fools for peace. They're fools for peace. That takes courage, doesn't it? He said every time he does this, he is scared. Of course he is scared. And he has a meditation practice he's had for years. It doesn't mean he won't be scared. But he is a fool. So the historical Buddha, he was a fool for peace too. He was a fool for peace. And his clan was a Shakya clan, and their capital was Kapilavastu, and there was wars going on. We think that our level of warfare is worse now. It's not any worse. Go back to any time in history, and it's not any worse. Not any worse. So here we are in Buddha's time. Here is Buddha. Here's a war coming up between the ancient armies of Magadha and Kapilavastu, his homeland. And he tries to head off the war. Because by now, he's the Buddha. People respect him, right? Supposedly. Supposedly, they respect him, they honor him, they want to follow him. You would think so, wouldn't you? You would think so. He tries logic and persuasion, but it doesn't work. At last, he sits in Zazen under a dead tree by the side of the battlefield. And then here, this is a quote, is from the Nikaya, from the scripture. Since it was very hot, the king of Magadha, couldn't understand why the Buddha was sitting under a dead tree. Usually people sit under beautiful green trees. So the king asked, "Why do you sit under the dead tree?" The Buddha calmly said to the king, "I feel cool, even under this tree, because it is growing near my native country." This really pierced the king's heart, and he was so greatly impressed by the message of the Buddha's action that he could go no further. Instead of attacking, he returned to his country. But the king's attendants still continued to encourage him to attack, and finally he did so. This time, unfortunately, Shakyamuni Buddha didn't have time to do anything. Without saying a word, he just stood and watched his country and his people being destroyed. Being destroyed. He was a fool. He was a fool. So those are the five components which I just made up this last week of being a fool, because I'm a fool myself, right? You won't find them in any scripture. You won't even find them in Alice in Wonderland. And how do you become a fool if you really want to become a fool? Well, you know how you become a fool if you come around here. By practicing meditation. That's how you become a fool. That's how you discover your fool nature. That's how you return to your fool nature. And you don't do it by just practicing it for 5 minutes every other Sunday, or every third Sunday, every fourth Sunday. It's the spirit of repetition. This is our practice for all these hundreds of years. Repetition, doing it over and over and over again. Until it really permeates, really penetrates your psyche. So, a friend of mine was here recently who came from out of town, and she came here, and she's not a Buddhist, whatever that means. She's not a Buddhist. And instead she does a Jon Kabat-Zinn style meditation for 3 to 5 minutes a day. Or 3 to 8 minutes a day. How many of you know what Jon Kabat-Zinn style meditation is? Raise your hand. Oh, some of you don't. A lot of you don't know. Oh, Jon Kabat-Zinn is just sitting down with no ritual, no bowing, no religious accoutrements at all, and just practicing being still wherever you are. And she practices that. She said, "Well, I'd like to come to Zen Center." "Cool," I said. She said, and she said, "I'll come on a Sunday, and how long do you sit before?" And I said, 40 minutes. And she said, "Oh, that's a long time." She said, "But I want to do that. I want to do that. I'll try that." So then afterwards, the next day, whenever I saw her, I said, "How was that?" And she said, "Not good." And I said, "Well, you do already meditation," she said, "but never for more than 10 minutes. And I had to sit and look at people. Why do you set it up on Sunday so people have to sit and look at people?" She said, "I couldn't have a moment of calmness because I was just checking everybody out." Or trying to pretend I wasn't checking everybody out. She said, and I said, "Well, you know, if you come the next Sunday, you can sit in there in the Founders Hall and you can face the wall." She said, "Oh, okay, I'll try that." So she came the next Sunday and she faced the wall. So then I said to her afterwards, How is that? She said, well, I don't know. I don't know if I want to talk about it. I said, oh, okay. She said, well, maybe I had 6 or 7 minutes out of 40 when I was concentrated. She said, 6 or 7 minutes? And I said, 6 or 7 minutes? I said, and you're not even experienced at doing these long meditations. She said, no, but it was such a waste of time. All that other time I was just thinking and comparing and complaining and planning my next week. And she's a high-level kind of executive woman. So she used to doing everything well. She's used to doing everything well. And so here she's wasting 33 minutes. 33 out of the 40 minutes. Completely wasting. When at least she could be out jogging around the lake if she was, if not going to be doing something, you know, productive. But even when she jogs around the lake, she's got to measure her heartbeat and wear all this paraphernalia and write her chart. And no offense, we all do this kind of thing, right? But as you become more and more foolish, you won't not need to do this kind of thing so much, okay? So, the spirit of repetition, that's the whole teaching. So I should end with Alice. Since I started with Alice in Wonderland, I will end with Alice. The spirit of repetition. The spirit of repetition on the part of the knight who's riding the horse in Alice in Wonderland. Alice had been with the knight on the horse for a while. And it had only been a short period of time, but the knight had already fallen off the horse 5 times. And Alice said to the knight, she could have said to the horse, I suppose, in Alice in Wonderland, you never know what's going to happen, right? She said to the knight, I'm afraid you've not had much practice in riding, she ventured to say, as she was helping him up from his 5th tumble. The knight looked very much surprised and a little offended at the remark. What makes you say that? He asked as he scrambled back into the saddle, keeping hold of Alice's hair with one hand to save himself from falling off on the other side. Because people don't fall off quite so often when they've had much practice. I've had plenty of practice, the knight said very gravely. Plenty of practice. That's the end of the story. That's the end of the story. And that's why we do this. We do this so that we can, at some point, be so involved in this riding that the riding and the falling are not experienced as two things separate. They're not experienced as two separate experiences. There's no separation at all. The falling is the riding, and the riding is the falling, and the falling is the riding. And that's our foolish behavior that we continue to practice moment after moment, day after day, year after year, century after century, kalpa after kalpa. Okay? Okay? So, questions, comments, foolish stories? And I promised the transcriber that I would repeat the question into the mic.
One of the pieces of courage is that when you're the fool, it rattles other people.
Uh-huh.
And you have to have the courage to know that there will be repercussions for your foolishness.
That's right. That's right. That's right. You have to have the courage. Oh, I'm supposed to. Well, that wasn't a question. No, I'm sure. I'm not sure if I can do this. I think I should pass the mic around. She said, what's your name?
Kate.
Kate said, Kate said that one of the things that is part of the fool's courageousness is that they have to know, they have to realize that they will have to deal with the ramifications of what happens. And that's certainly the case. That's certainly the case. When you behave as a fool, there's a difference between the Zen fool and the naive fool. The naive fool is childish. The naive fool is childish. The Zen fool is maybe childlike, but not childish. Not childish. Shrewd. But shrewd coming from the love of life. The love of life. The love of want, the peace desiring need to help all beings, support all beings. So thank you. Thank you. Yes?
I just have a comment. That story of the knight falling off the horse reminded me of this old Dudley Moore joke.
A Dudley Moore joke?
Yeah.
Oh, now I'm going to have to tell a joke. Okay. Okay.
He said, Dudley Moore said he's learned from all his mistakes. He could repeat every one of them exactly.
Thank you. Dudley Moore has learned from each one of his mistakes to repeat every one exactly. Anything else? Anything else this morning, you guys?
I was just going to say real quick that this is Nancy Hafner. when we were down at Hokioji probably last year sometime, I don't remember who told this story, but they talked about how Katagiri Roshi, when he was down there, one day they got into a game of tag. And he was running around in his robes, and he was just totally into it and running really fast, and people were amazed how fast he could run. And there wasn't any shame or embarrassment. He was like a kid running in his robes, and that made an impression on people, I think.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Thank you. I missed that one. I missed that one. Anything else? Yeah.
I wonder about the contradiction in meditation about being empty.
Mm-hmm.
And no ears, no eyes, no nose. And being present right here, right now.
Yes. So she wonders about the contradiction in meditation between being empty, as it says in the Heart Sutra, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, and being here right now. Uh-huh. Interesting contradiction, huh? Interesting contradiction. Well, the more we're able just to be right here with our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, the less we need to categorize them. The less we need to say, oh, sight, sound, smell, touch. And what this is talking about, this sutra, the Heart Sutra, actually, it was what you're quoting from, and we're going to be having a class in the Heart Sutra starting day after Labor Day. It's saying that these categories are arbitrary, that they're made up. When we say eyes, ears, tongue, body, mind, those are categories, those are labels. And when you let go of those labels, it's not that you don't smell, that you don't taste, that you don't touch. It's rather that you don't cling to the idea of taste, of touch. Because actually they're all synesthetic anyway. They all come together anyway. Also, what's being criticized is an earlier Buddhist idea that when you let go of thinking, that you experience things individually in a sensory way. You experience just seeing, just smelling, just tasting. So that practice has been going on for 500 years when the Heart Sutra was written. And then the Heart Sutra is saying, wait, you've turned this into a religion. You've become rigid about it. These are your new categories, and get rid of those categories too. So it helps to understand the historical context. And or you know, you can just be foolish and not understand the historical context. Pardon?
Can I ask?
Sure.
So,
wait, did I ask? Did I say this into here? Did I say the question into here? I did. Oh, okay. That's good. Thank you. I wonder if do you think that could be what she's saying is that when we're just doing something, whether we're just smelling, just tasting, just touching, just sitting, that we're able to let go of it, of anything else and just be here, and so there's no contradiction. There's no contradiction, but also some contradiction is going to come up because you are human. Something on the next moment is going to come up. On the next moment, there's going to be tension because human beings exist in tension. And it's not totally negative. It's just that we're usually overwhelmed by the tension. But we exist in tension because we exist at the juncture between yesterday and tomorrow. And we say, oh, now, 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 now. But there's always yesterday and tomorrow. So, but that tension is tensionless if we're just doing it. We're just doing it. Anything else?